Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. I got a beauty for you today, dear listener. And once in a while, I just get this errant email, and I did a couple of months ago, about a house that had been burned in one of our notorious Santa Barbara fires, but had risen from the ashes in a beautiful way. And then an artist fell in love with the property. That's Amy, who we're going to speak to. Amy Barnard fell in love with the property, visited it a couple of times, and said, I can write a book. I can do a book. I can do the photography. I can do why I love the place, and I can show it in my work, in my photography. And lo and behold, she has. I found out about the property. Looked at the book. I looked at all of the people involved, and we're going to talk to the owners today of this beautiful property. And we're also going to talk about where you can get this book and et cetera, et cetera. Leslie Dinenberg did a wonderful article just recently, and I love the title that she used, which is Capturing a Home's Essence. And in that article, which if you want to look at it, it was April 9th of 2026. In that article, she talks about the home and how it was rebuilt, like I said, risen from the ashes. And what impressed me was Amy's direction with her book. So Amy took a direction that was very different, I thought, than Leslie's article, which is she kind of comes into the book with the understanding that the thesis of the book is the house as a space for entertaining, a space for understanding family, friends, et cetera, and how they move through a space and what they enjoy about a space. And there's an incredible shot in the book, Amy, I got to say, of the poolside, where I just feel, I'm there. I'm there. Here's my white wine. I'm already there. My toes are in the water. I mean, how you got that, I don't know. But the idea is that this is, I think, a story that is a great story to tell about Santa Barbara. It's a survival story. And it's also part of our wonderful Santa Barbara tradition of traditional and eclectic mixes of styles and designs, but in a very grand way that's also accessible, if I can say it that way.
So I'm glad to hear that's you outside by the pool, because I was wondering if that was just a stranger.
No, that's a statue. That's the Aphrodite you put in, but you forgot.
Okay, all right.
She's a little older than the one you ordered, but that's okay. I mean, she is a vintage, you know, she's a Greek god anyway. So yeah, that's me, Michael. Okay. I want to say this is, Petimento is one of those extraordinary spaces in our town. And we are going to speak with the owners, G. Stephen Wright. And he is a retired very high up with the Social Security Administration in the national headquarters. He has a bachelor's degree in political science and psychology from the University of New Mexico. And he was at Thunderbird for his master's. And it was School of Global Management. Stephen and Michael go back a while, and this is not their first building project. And we'll talk about the ARC. The first project that they worked on together was 1890 Place in Baltimore, Maryland. And then they did some properties in Beverly Hills and some properties in Santa Barbara. And of course, their property that is now Petimento was, you know, destroyed. Up on the hill, and we're going to talk about what that felt like. Michael, who I've been speaking to, is to set this interview up, and thank you to Michael. This is a Renaissance man. Michael can do everything but, you know, dance backwards in heels while he's doing it. He's an artist, He's a designer. He's a contractor. A little bit of a poet, too, because I asked for the notes of his talk at Rubenstein Chan Gallery just recently when he was a member of the artists that were showing there. It was all a show about words. And Bonnie Rubenstein at the time said, you got to meet Michael. He's one of our most interesting artists. She sent me part of the portfolio, and then she explained to me what Michael was going to be showing and also said the opportunity to come and hear his lecture. And so I want to talk about his arc as well through his journey. And then I want to talk to Amy. Amy is with us today. She's an internationally published photographer. She specializes in interiors, architecture, hospitality, and travel. That's the way I was talking about. The book is not like, okay, here's the house, here's the plans, blah, blah, blah. It's like you're a guest and you're being led through the house is the, sort of the feel of the book. And she's been seen in Architectural Digest, Vogue, Elle Decor, Modern Luxury Interiors, etc. She's worked with boutique hotels over her career. She's summa cum laude from Brooks, yay, here in town. And she's a Bachelor of Arts degree there. She's an equestrian. She specializes in dressage. She's a skier. She lives in Santa Monica. And we are so honored that all three of you are here. And I want to start with Michael, actually. So, Michael, you know, I lost, I didn't lose a house, but I was up in, I was through a fire in the area they call Nolita, you know, between Goleta and Santa Barbara. And I was way up on top of a mountain there. I lost two cars, but I didn't lose the house, but there was so much smoke. An issue with, you know, combustibles burning that virtually I did, had to rebuild. I can remember seeing the house go as we were at tee off that night. And I thought that the end had come, you know, and I'm wondering, did you see what you were going to do that you ended up doing with Pedimento, or did you just have to get over the loss?
Well, Stephen and I both watched our house burn on live TV because they kept going up and down Holly Road as it was on fire. And our house is fairly distinctive. So we watched that. He and I both had two different reactions. We had gone to L.A. Just on a short weekend trip to do some maintenance on our pied-à-terre down there. Stephen's reaction was to get a pad of paper and start drawing up plans for the new house. My reaction was to lay on the floor. I was just stunned by the loss. One of the things you brought up about Amy and her approach to the book, how she saw the house as a place to entertain as well as the house itself, is I've always treated antiques and the home and my art as stories, and that every piece has its own story and the equivalent of a soul. It has the emotions it brings along from other people and what you're trying to communicate. So that's why the loss hit me particularly hard. But it was Stephen who really got us gangbusters going to build a new place.
So happy to hear that. And also happy to hear, you know, we haven't met formally. I'd love to talk more, but so I've been an appraiser for 35 years and I've worked with objects. And so when I went back after, you know, my first set of kids were old enough, then I went back and I did a master's in architectural history and then did a PhD. And I was in the art history department, but I insisted on doing a PhD about the inner life of things. And so I got in combination with the depth psychology department at the university, and between my department and so they were on my committee, I wrote my dissertation on why collectors collect and what the spirit is behind the collections that they amass. And so we are kindred spirits. There was something about the house at Pedimento that called to me because there's such a rich narrative.
Well, that's interesting. You were working with the deaf psychology department. Since objects have a limited ability to explain their history, where they come from, I was saying earlier to Amy and Stephen, how one artist whose work I purchased years ago had her bio printed on something and attached to the back of her painting. so that in the future, someone will be able to know some of the history of where the piece came from, which is what's missing most of the time from the antique from Europe, where whose history you just don't know much about.
Do you know, I have to say, I agree with you up to a point. There's a point at which, so you and I know Stephen too, from just looking at the book, there's a point at which the object starts to stand on its own two legs and speak. Mm-hmm. And that is a point that can be really lost the more education you have about the era, the way of manufacturer, et cetera, et cetera. So you can kind of get, I'll give you an example. So I was my first 20 years in the business. So I was asked at the museum, the historical museum, if I would consider being a docent because they were educating a group of kids that were interested in museum studies at Westmont. And it was a new degree. And would I be a docent and lead them around the decorative objects departments and the archives underground, et cetera. So I said, yeah, I'd be thrilled to. It's wonderful pro bono work. I'd love to do it, et cetera. And so I armed myself by researching all of the material that I was going to introduce to them as far as the museum was concerned. And I was halfway through this lecture and I can never forget this. I was standing in front of a Spanish colonial casone and I was looking at it. I was looking at the depth of carving, the relief work, the joinery, the use of woods, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I told them that, you know, because the hinge work is going to point to the 17th century, but this is going to point 16th century. I was going blah, blah, blah. Something hit me looking at that casone and it started to talk to me and I went down on my knees and I said, okay, there's too much here. I've got too much going on upstairs. Tell me what you want me to hear. And darn it, if that thing didn't say, shut up and let me be me and let me teach the students what I can teach the students. And I just said, I've had too much chatter for 20 years, and I'm going to look at the object before I start looking at it, what's inside my head. And that led me to start researching for my PhD work, because it was so clear to me that the object speaks. And, you know, and that's, I think, what I hear you saying. And when I look at your house, you know, you've got Robert Longo and you've got Aubusson next to each other. And I was thinking, oh, God, this is fantastic because they talk to each other. Now you got two narratives, two linear narratives, but they're talking.
You know, what's interesting is in my artist talk, I had two friends with me. One, since I was a fine artist, I had one friend who's a product designer, Joel Sharon, and one friend who's a musical art critic, classical music, Peter Schlur. His point about art, because we were talking before when people say, what does your painting mean? And what you're talking about the history and knowledge about the chest, was he said that art, very successful pieces, and I think this applies to objects, should be metaphor machines, where they're producing so many things that you can read into them that you can personalize it to you. So I do prefer when people ask me about something, what it means, to find out without sounding like a pap psychologist, what does it mean to you? Because that's really much more important. And after they figure that out, then I can give them the information. Much like when I go to a museum, I love finding out all the things you were just talking about, but I like to appreciate the piece first. So it's fascinating that that was the approach you took.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was teaching, so I had a fellowship at Winterthur. And I remembered studying, Mr. DuPont's collection there. And I was thinking, okay, there's so much material. There's so many wonderful books. And the scholarship around Winterthur has been extensive, you know, likely because of the DuPont money, et cetera, et cetera. So I was very interested in that. I was super young, was in between two degrees. I was very young. And I thought, okay, what would it, and everybody was supposed to show that they understood the year's study by bringing an object and then completely dismantling it and building it back up as a final exam. And everybody brought something, you know, a wonderful 17th century chinoiserie piece, da-da-da-da-da-da, so we're going like this. I brought a toaster, and I thought, let me see if I can you know, do this kind of depth analysis on a toaster. And I kind of, you know, like out of six professors, three failed me and three passed me with flying colors. They ended up passing because I wanted to see if it held up for all, like you said, is the object piece of machinery, is it something that we launch ourselves into, or is it launching itself into us? Anyway, enough about that. I want to talk about the house, and I want to talk about your collections. I know that you've got a lot of resources. In fact, you just got back from Europe, and you've got a lot of resources and opportunity to collect in Europe. But is that where your majority decor comes from? Tell me about how you furnish, Michael.
Well, part of the things that are in the house were of my healing, which was retail therapy, because I found that what I lost, there were so many beautiful things with history. And with the first thing that I bought, we had a trip we couldn't cancel to Venice, Italy. And on Murano, I bought two matching flower vases that were just stunning. And it gave me the lesson that there are beautiful things in the world. And I like attaching myself all around the world. I buy a lot of things in Pasadena, at flea markets, at estate sales in Europe. We just came back from a trip through London, Belgium, and Holland. And I came back with two small statuettes and four old paintings, small works, that needed to be cleaned and some loving attention. So it really is a matter of what sings to me. And Stephen and I both like things that you just generally don't see. I like to have, we have a water clock in our bar, and most people say, what is a water clock? And I get to explain it to them. And I love it when there's something that people just don't know about.
So you use them as narrative starters as well, your objects. It starts the narrative.
I think so. It evokes things in people. And then we're already, because people, when they come by, there's some social event which brings them, if it's just cocktails or an evening or staying as a guest with us, and it can bring things up for them. I think, as Amy had said, the environment, we wanted to create an environment that reflects us, that showcases, like I said, unusual things, and brings out a certain kind of event for people. We recently had, Amy had a location wedding in Ireland at Ballyfin, which was tremendous. We have a book about that house here. And we had several of the wedding guests of hers that we really liked up to the house. And it was wonderful celebrating this with them and having our house reflect some of what they had felt at Ballyfin and creating new experiences for them.
Okay, so there's a lot of cross-cultural stuff going on. Question, so do you and Stephen always agree?
We have a system which has worked excellently for us for the last 40 years. A therapist taught it to us, because oftentimes with couples, they will make a decision and one person sounds like they're coming back and reopening the decision, when really what they're trying to do is just communicate level of passion about it. So it's like, I'd like to buy this vase. Well, I don't want to do that. I said, are you sure you don't want to buy the vase? So what he taught us to do when there's difficulty in communicating is saying, I'd like to buy the vase. And you have to be very honest. I want to buy the vase a 7 out of 10. And Stephen would say, I don't want to buy the vase an 8 out of 10. I really don't like it. So we don't buy the vase, because he cares more about the no than I care about the yes. And you rarely end up at the same level. We've only been at the same level once or twice, and those we just put off.
Oh, boy. Wow, that's fantastic.
Great advice.
You know what's running in my tape recorder is it about the vase? Is it about the vase? So in this general question, is it about the vase? Or is it about, I don't like the direction in which you're taking that this vase will launch us into, for example? So is it forethought? Is it past thought? You know, it's so difficult to say, well, I just don't feel great about this day. So I'm going to be, you know, dig my heels into it, or I needed a nap anyway. I'm leaving you alone. you can buy your vase if you want. I'm just wondering, you know, I know you've got a psychology background. I'm just wondering how that would work with all the subtext, you know, in a relationship. And I love it that you put it that way. Give me a scale, and it's put onto a level of aesthetics that both of you are pros at. So you say, I'm a professional, meaning I have a great eye. Now I'm going to throw this onto the level of aesthetics, because that way you're not getting a lot of this subtext involved. You're keeping it on the aesthetic level. Am I thinking right about this? I want to use it with my partner, by the way.
Well, I would say it's several things. It's context. So I was speaking purely about level of wanting to take an action of purchasing or not. But what you said gives me the sense, which is very true, context of where it's going to be in the house, because people will say, is this a nice object? Well, it depends what you do with it. If you place it in the wrong style home, it may or may not work at all. And then it also depends on how much joy it will bring somebody. Stephen has a couple things and I have a couple things that the person really doesn't like. But it gives the person who wants it so much joy. Well, that's what is part of being in a relationship is that you make compromises for your partner's happiness.
Yeah. So just to say, I'm sort of backtracking. You've been through this tremendous loss. Stephen watched the house burn. You watched the house burn. Stephen got out of bed, started drawing up the new house immediately. And you were on the floor kicking and screaming and crying, and I can understand.
Just the crying.
So it was a different reaction. But the idea is, now you've been through that kind of loss. I have too. And a lot of my work right now is in the Palisades, which is, you know, as an appraiser.
Horrible.
Yeah. And we talk about that. But the idea is that those people that have been through the loss, one of my clients in the Palisades said, forget it, I'm just selling everything. What's left, I'm selling. I don't want to be attached to objects anymore. On the same level, my question to him, as I was writing the appraisal, we were going to take it to court. I said, would you then, if this happened again, what object would you grab? You've divorced yourself from the life through objectivity. So what now would you grab as if there was another fire? What would you grab? I was trying to think to myself how much this matters to him. You know, what would you grab? And he said, absolutely, I would grab the Warhol, and this is why, and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, really he was telling me two things. I don't want to be tied down by my objects, but I sure do want to be tied down by the things I really love. So, you know, it was kind of a cross mix. And I guess I want to throw that question to Stephen. So Stephen, God forbid that you're ever in a house that burns and you have to witness it again, but what object would you grab?
You know, I think the object I might grab would be too big to carry out. And it's one of the things Michael really doesn't like. it's a statue, almost life size, of Scaramouche. And I got him in a gallery in San Miguel de Allende. And Michael was walking by, and I was with some friends in the gallery. I said, oh, Michael, come in and look at these. It was this old artist creating these things. So Michael, being polite, said, oh, it's very nice. And then he left. And so when I got back to the hotel, I said, oh, I bought that one statue, Scaramouche. And he said, oh, you didn't. I hate it. So, but anyway, it's one of my favorite things. But I don't think I'd be able to. He's a little large to be carting around someplace. But so I don't know that I can just say one favorite thing. I mean, I always would grab my passport. That's for sure.
You know, Stephen's interesting. When we had one house that we were building in Beverly Hills area, we used to, when we were doing these houses, take one or two rooms and build the whole house, tear everything down, but those two rooms, build the whole house, and then remodel the rooms. So at one point, we were down to one room, which was my office, my storage room, our kitchen, our bathroom, tool storage. There was a little mouse that would run around the floor. And Stephen had one shelf with an orchid on it, a book, and what was the liquor?
Bottle of scotch.
A bottle of scotch. And that was his signpost, which he would focus on, and that was what gave him a sense of security and place and dignity. And I found that really fascinating. He, for me, I'm more attached to things because I anthropomorphize them more. And there's a lot of transitional objects from people from our lives who've passed out. And so he treats things differently. He places a lot more emphasis, I think, on the experience and the memories of the experience. So he doesn't need things as much as I do.
Okay, so if that's the case, Richard's giving us a sign, we got to go to a quick break. So maybe I'll ask this question. I want to say that, you know, Michael began life as a creative and a consummate creative, so that we have in what Michael has done with his life as an artist, as a designer, as a builder, is, you know, there's both a verticality to the way he's approaching the questions I'm asking him, and also a horizontal kind of overview, which made me think of Michael as, you know, the archetypal polymath, Renaissance man, et cetera, et cetera. Stephen, I want to know how, if I got that right about Michael.
And yes.
Did I? Okay, so I got that right. So you, do you ever, okay, so with my partner and myself, they don't like that I put things in the way of their path, let's say, that there's an easy chair that should go in a spot where it's kind of catty-corner to the couch, but you got to walk around it. They like to walk straight through. They don't like that I put something in their footpath. So that's always been a problem because I like a cozy area to sit and talk. So how do you figure that out? Well, I'll move it when my friend comes over for tea, and they'll move it back so that they don't trip on it, even though they're an athlete and they shouldn't be tripping on stuff anyway. So the chair goes back and forth and back. And so it's like, when you make a design decision, and you've made some big design decisions and, you know, a large estate, when you make that design decision, do you ever go back historically and question, you know, you made me do that. I didn't really want to do that. That was, you know, that was something that I didn't like because you said I should do it and I did it, blah, blah, blah. Does it ever happen? Do you hammer it out beforehand? Stephen, I'm asking you.
Yeah. Well, basically, Michael is very generous, as talented as he is. I've been drawing floor plans since, you know, I was a child. I just have always loved the concept of creating environments. So we've done 8 houses. One was a restoration in Baltimore, but the rest have been, you know, rebuilds or complete new builds. And because it's such an important thing to me, and because Michael has so many other artistic outlets, he's always let me more or less take the lead and decide how those spaces will look and how everything will be designed. And because he's also a builder, I can tell him, despite what the architect designs or says, no, I want it this way. And Michael says, it will be that way. You know, the architect is a small part of what we're doing. He just needs to really do our permits for us and things like that. So Michael's very generous in the fact that because it's so important to me, and I don't have all the other outlets that he has, I really get to take the lead on all that design.
I think that's remarkable. And Richard, I know we got to go to break, but I want to kind of prime the pump by quoting something from the artist talk, Michael's artist talk that Bonnie sent me. And the quote goes as followed. I was talking with Peter about the concept of pedimento and how there should be synonyms for the word when applied in different disciplines. For example, in psychology, Michael writes, when you are thrust into a family situation, which is why I asked that question of Stephen, or surrounded by a childhood friend, part of your past selves can emerge which would be called regression. And that's why I asked about what object you would grab. Your younger self is showing through. In our house, so much of our lives were destroyed there. The current house is therefore an homage, a memorial, and a palette composed of the best of our previous homes. Or the layers of what I'm thinking about are the layers of the pedimento. So I want to discuss that quote when we get back from the break. And the very assiduously used word regression, which could have a lot of different resonances, historically speaking, personally speaking, etc. I noticed so much baronial style furniture in the book, in the house, which is a great California tradition, you know, from Hearst on and previous. So I noticed that, and I want to talk about that a little bit. And Richard, are you still there? Okay, so what we're going to do, Richard's going to do, okay, hi, Richard. We're going to do 2 seconds of break, and then we're back. I want to talk about this idea of what pedimento is. And by the way, you don't have to look it up. I have the definition for you here. It's an image in oil painting, classically, when the image bleeds through. And it's not always done because the previous work was crummy. It's done because it's a reworking of an idea sometimes. And so it's a layer. And in those days, we're talking about Renaissance era. In those days, you know, you made your own canvas and you made your own paints, or your staff did. And to rework a canvas, you got to scrape off the old if you weren't thrilled or you didn't think it, you know, was going to make the money it should. And so that was called, because you can see that in many cases behind the most presentation of the oil paint in the front, or it could be tempera, for example. So the idea is that's what pedimento means, and that's the name of the house. I want to reflect on that, and if there's any sadness behind it, if there's, like Michael said, regression, if there's any historicism, if it's a narrative use of the word, if it's an active use of the word, is it a verb, is it an adjective, is it a noun? Okay, those are things I want to talk about. Don't turn the dial back. I'm just reintroducing a wonderful house, a wonderful book. I encourage it greatly. I'm talking with the author and the photographer of the book, Amy Barnard. I'm talking with G. Stephen Wright. And I'm talking with Michael Vilkin. And basically, this is a dream team. A powerhouse dream team, and I was secretly, dear listener, urging all of our gang here if they would allow the house to be on the AIA tour one of these years. I'd love to see that happen. So when we get back from the break, we're going to talk about the meaning of the word pedimento. And do you always use the word when you talk about the house? Is it always we're going home to pedimento, or is it the house? I just those little clues I'm looking for. Okay, Richard, let's go to quick break. So when we went to the break, we talked a little bit about why the house is called pedimento and what that means in art historical terms, what it means in the history of art. We know that it means something that appraisers like myself really look for, and now we've got spectrometry to look at it even closer. It's how some great things are discovered. Because of the canvases that were scraped off, and many times it's not a pejorative thing. It's that this is something that needs to happen because canvas is in short supply, etc. How did the house come to be named pedimento? Do you use always the name when you talk about the house? Stephen, I see you're thinking.
Yes, we always refer to pedimento, as do all of our friends. Everyone calls it. I've named all of our houses. And Pentimento, I came up with for the reason you said the Italian term applied to painting, but also Lillian Hellman also wrote a book of kind of a layering of memories called Pentimento. And we designed this house to really have something from all of that previous designs and houses we have done. So this house is a layering of all the things that we have done in some degree before. Things get repeated, like maybe it's a bookcase, maybe it's a window seat, maybe, but looking around the house for Michael and myself, we can see all those past environments that we created.
Do you see all the past environments? Is it eras that you're, because obviously the objects are gone from the past. So are you recreating in terms of eras? Like, okay, we're going to use 17th century style furniture here, or no?
No, it's more just elements, just certain types of, say a certain type of dark, deep set window or some other architectural design. Let Michael speak to this a little bit.
Yeah,
I was just going to add that in previous homes where we've had a design issue and we've worked out a solution that we really liked, and we'll on occasion think, well, what's been your favorite room at this house or favorite bedroom? Where was it? What was it like? So we took all those elements that were our favorite pieces or that worked out very successfully, and we repeated them here. So they harken back for us, not a previous design era, but more from our personal life of things that we created.
Did you have to go back to the other seven houses to find those elements?
No, just from our memory.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Amy, a question for you. So obviously these are very visionary people, Michael and Stephen. You're a visionary person. So was there an approach that you took in any particular room setting that they did not like?
I don't think so. No, I think what was exciting for me was that when I started doing the test shoot, which was, I don't know, how long was I up here for that test shoot? 3-4 days?
Something like that.
And I just came up and I was just shooting with my phone, just kind of grabbing the ideas that I wanted. And the first thing that they said to me was that they hadn't seen the house seen in that way before. And that really excited me because I was showing them what I, as an individual, am seeing here. And I was just thrilled that they thought that was exciting.
I get it. Okay. So that's exactly the opposite of what I was thinking. Like, oh, no, I really like, you should move this here. You should do this here, Amy, blah, 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 blah. But it sounds like just the idea of that ocular extra that you brought made the house feel seen.
Yes. Yes. And I will say that as an artist, as a photographer, I don't enjoy creating something from a blank slate. I like seeing what's already there and capturing imagery that is already placed, but that other people maybe not see. I actually see in frame. So when I'm walking through a room or I'm walking through a garden or whatever, I will literally walk and my eye will come into frame and I'm like, there's the shot. And so I'm not actually trying to figure it out ahead of time. I see it as I am in the space.
Amy used to work photographing people for many years, which I think is probably a good background for this. You can have someone who doesn't think they photograph well, and Amy can make them look wonderful in a photograph.
Thank you.
So I think that's what we like our house and see it as a nice looking place. But she added that really that magical layer to the way she captured it. You're welcome.
I see. Okay. So the idea is that was they called the Cartier-Bresson, the crucial moment where Amy's walking around with the frame right in her brain of, okay, this is going to be this is going to be that. So Amy, when you put the book together, I can remember in my really like kiddie years, I worked when darkrooms were still around. I worked for a photographer. He's a wedding photographer, and he was an older guy, and he could take what is it, a proof sheet they used to call it? He would take it. Yeah.
Yes.
And he'd take, maybe there are 36 or whatever many little tiny squares, Yep. And within 2 seconds, he'd know which one of the 36 he wanted to work with. And it'd be like the red, what was it? The red, like crayon pencil was like, no. And then boom. Yeah, that's it. So did you go through many permutations to discover what you wanted to put in your book?
I would say that from my test shoot, the majority of those showed up in the final book, but we had a number of slightly different angles or times of day. And then Michael would actually use the technique he was telling you earlier, where he's like, okay, I like that picture, maybe a 6 out of 10. And I'm like, okay, well, I really like that as a 9 out of 10. And he's like, okay, it's in the book. And so that was kind of how we went through and chose the final imagery. But a lot of it, we just agreed. We both, I think we have a very similar eye as far as what we see is, I don't know, beautiful.
Well, that and Amy would have a particular shot in mind. And she would let me look through the lens on her computer, what she was doing. And I would help move things around or add accessories or just sort of clean the shot up. So it was her aesthetic, but I was helping her realize that. And I think we work really well together as a team, so much so that we have joked about doing that on some future project.
Yes.
I wish you would. I think that would be so wonderful to have that. You know, it's so funny that, Amy, I'm just thinking about, you know, I was in a board meeting and it was a Zoom board meeting. And there was a number of people on one side of the table, and they were talking about some important things. There's a lot of money being spent, et cetera, et cetera. And I can remember thinking, there's nobody here that has any eye at all, because there was a water bottle, like as if Michael was there, but the computer would be here. And by the way, dear listener, I'm seeing my guests. And it doesn't go any further than that, but I'm seeing my, so in this Zoom meeting, there was water bottles and a big plate of cookies, and I couldn't see the people. It's like, nobody here has studied composition, obviously, you know, because this is terrible, you know? So that's really interesting to know that it was a collaborative thing, but that you, that Amy was allowed to be the artist that she is, and the setting was important to Michael, et cetera. Okay. So tell me about that when we, before we went to break, we talked a little about this idea of regression. And then Michael brought up the fact that, you know, they've done, Stephen and he had done, this is the eighth house that they've done together. And this one was a fairly challenging work because, of course, its shadow was lost in the fires, et cetera. So the idea is, you know, your quote from the, quote from Michael's talk, your younger self is always showing through.
Well, I think that,
go ahead.
I apologize for interrupting.
I was going to say, how did that manifest in this permutation, in this house, in Petimento?
How our younger selves show through. I think it's a matter of the things that remind us of our past. We have accident, we actually have a chapel. Neither of us are religious, but we had a small room, and I found a really beautiful Victorian prie-dieu, which we put in there, and then ended up filling with religious artifacts and antiques and pocket watch cases with the faces of people in our lives we've lost on hanging on ribbons, and that's all throughout the room. And you go in there, and you're flooded with memories and your past. And I think psychologically, the healthiest people I know are able to access their inner child and become silly when they want to be. But also, as is typical of a lot of our friends, Stephen loves throwing 8-course dinner parties, which he cooks for, and we have help. He has help come in. We decorate the table, and these people can be very elegant. So our friends can enjoy their lives in many different ways and different styles. And I think Amy catches that as well, too. We have some dinner party shots, which are very elaborate, and I think she brings the joy of those, even though we only have one dinner party shot with guests, but she really brings those to life.
You do a lot, Amy, because I noticed in some of the shots there's the hint of it just was been left occupied. There's maybe a wine glass or two. There's usually like a charcuterie or something that's, it's just okay there. You know, there's obviously human remains in the shot that, okay, it was a part of the entertainment process. I love that because it kind of introduces you into the theme of the book.
I add one thing about Amy? Michael and I never, ever thought about doing a book of the house. That would have never even occurred to us. And Amy came in because we were going to have an article in one of the local magazines. And she just fell in love with the place and she had such enthusiasm for it. But it was really, it's her talent and her desire to have this book exist. That's the whole reason we have it. Michael and I, this would have never happened. We never had a thought about having a book of a home.
Which amazes me because when I walked in, I just couldn't get over how much it speaks to you. And the story about the fire and just who they are as people. I'm going to go back to the party. As we started putting the book together, I realized that we needed people in the book. I said so much of what I wanted to do the book about was about the life that you bring to the house and the life that you allow because of all the people that you have. They love to have groups of people come for a weekend. I mean, and so I wanted that to show up in the book, that it is truly lived in and loved and it inspires, and it's used as not only just for, you know, parties and celebrating, but also as a place to reflect and just be. And it's so special.
Well, it's interesting you say a place to reflect. And then the previous like paragraph in this interview was Michael describing this chapel that Stephen and he designed with a Prédieu and then the interesting artifacts that are religious artifacts, although the two of them are not religious, but that there's a spirituality, religious means a ritual group speak. And there's a you know, spirituality concerned with this wonderful idea of pocket watches where the faces are people that are lost to them. Or, you know, former people that they've known. How did you think of that? I mean, where did that come from? That's a brilliant idea. I'm going to steal that, as a matter of fact.
It started with some things I inherited from my father, which included a pocket watch that was his father's. And it wasn't working. It wasn't a very expensive watch. So I took the insides out and put a picture of him inside that. And then because he had been in the military, he had been a physician down in Panama, I put a ribbon on it. So it looked a little bit like an award, a medal. And I realized what I was doing is I was showing how time had stopped for him. But it keeps going for us because, as they say, people are alive as long as they're remembered or thought of in one way or the other. And what I hadn't realized is now between relatives and friends, we unfortunately have a number of people in there. It's an odd feeling to go in there and be surrounded by so many of these people who, much like in a TV show, a fantasy TV show, come back and you can have conversations with them if that's something that occurs to you.
Can I tell a story? When I was shooting that room, for no reason whatsoever, my equipment stopped working. And I got so frazzled. And I was like, what is going on? And I kept retrying and retrying and retrying. And all of a sudden, I thought, I need permission from these people to do this. Because I was photographing them. And so I literally stopped and had a little conversation asking for their approval and just thanking them for allowing me to be present to do that. My stuff came back on and I continued shooting.
Not surprised that Kronos, yeah, the Kronos, he's a powerful one. That's an amazing thing.
We had one friend who we'd known back in Baltimore when we lived there. I lived with Stephen there from 83 to 87. And we lost touch with him. And for various reasons, we thought he had passed away. And so he was one of the people we had up in one of these photos in the chapel. And then about 2 years ago, he popped up on my Facebook page. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to take him down from the chapel. He never knew that he'd been up there.
Gosh. Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So I want to finish the interview just asking questions of all three of you. As you think about the project and Petamento and what it is there somebody from your past who you wish would be able to come back and see the property?
Mm. For me, I think it would be probably my mother, only because both my parents were proud of the work that I did. She took a particular interest, and she lived in Hope Ranch. And I think the fact that we ended up moving to Santa Barbara and had this house not far from her, and she did see the original house that was here when we bought the lot. So I think for her, that would have been a really nice sort of period on the sentence for her.
What about Stephen?
I would say the same thing, my mother, because she always enjoyed our homes so much. And she was in the first rebuild of this property that burned down. And but she had passed away before we built this house. Actually, she died just before the house burned down. And yes, I think because she always enjoyed the gardens and the houses so much, I would like for her to have seen it.
Is she in the chapel?
She is.
Yeah. Maybe she has seen it.
Maybe, yes. Yeah.
I should take
Amy, how about you?
For a walk around the house.
Oh, I would love for my father to see it. My father was, I felt, a Renaissance man in his own way, even though he was in business, but he has his PhD in higher education. So he and I really connected on a very emotional, spiritual level. Yeah, I would have loved him. And he's the one who really inspired me to be a photographer. He was an amateur photographer, but when I was 7, asked for my first camera from him. And he and I really bonded with that.
That's an amazing story. You know, it's interesting, Michael, that you and Stephen name your houses. So just tell you that I think I mentioned this to you. I'm not sure, but, you know, how a house, the sense of place, this idea of, you know, the house is so much a part, you know, and if you think about the words, yeah, I know you love words. I think about the words around house, you know, habitation. And there's some really ancient words around house, home, husbandry, et cetera. There's all these words, you know, possession. Possessions, you know, chattel. I mean, there's all these words that have to do with the treasure of a house and the treasures in the house. So I was thinking, oh, interesting, you know, and the little house I was telling you about at the beginning of the show that, you know, not far from where Richard is, Richard came to look at my houses and end up buying a house too, our producer. And that house was called the Gatehouse for many, many years, for 100 years. Well, when I looked at the house and I thought, okay, you know, can I raise up the pennies to buy this? Because it was adjunct to those other properties. Can I raise up the money to buy it? My mom was very sick. She died. She's 96 years old. So she was kind of on her last days. And I was looking at the property and I was saying, no, no, no. I mean, there's too much going on right now. I'm going to have to do so much, you know, back in New York for my mom and her family. I'm not going to even think about this house. And then I sent the people didn't want anybody in the house, and my realtor actually made some kind of friends and was able to see the house. And she uncovered an old stone, and the stone had a carved stone, and it said the Gatehouse. And she said, I did get in the house. I took pictures for you just in case you get back from, you know, your mom's and you want to see more about the house. And she sent me the pictures, and I saw the stone. It was the Gatehouse. 4 hours later, my brother called and said, you know, our mom passed. And, you know, my brother said, you know, she died very peacefully, all that. And I'm looking at this picture at the same time of the Gatehouse. And I said to my brother, mm-hmm. okay, I'm looking at a house called the Gatehouse. He says, well, mom's going through that gate. I said, okay. I called my realtor. I said, I'm buying it. She says, don't you want to go negotiate? She said, no, I don't want to negotiate. I want to buy that house. So I bought the gatehouse. And then I thought, okay, my realtor then, when she knew the story, she carved me a piece of wood. I guess her husband was, and the wood itself is a placard, and it says, and my mother's name was Eleanor. So the placard says Eleanoria Gatehouse, which was my house is now not the gatehouse anymore. It's called Eleanoria after my mom. So that little house is Eleanoria. The two houses next to it are Calandia and Orlandia, because those are my two grandkids' names, Orla and Callan. So and I'm leaving one house to each. So those are the two names associated. And I couldn't have a house without a name.
Mm-hmm. I think names are important. And I'm finding, I've been playing Lumosity, which is a memory game. And I find that certain of the games, it gives me an advantage when I speak, at least to myself, the name of the object that I'm looking at or trying to remember something. And there's also a real sense of character that names bring to the person. So I always find it interesting if Amy were named Nancy or Lucille, how she may or may not be different from being raised, being called by a different name and treated differently because she's got a different name.
Yeah.
Totally agree. My sister Nan was christened Nancy, and she said, no one's ever going to take me seriously, so I'm going to be Nan for the rest of my life. It's very interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting. And it's interesting the name you pick, too. I mean, Stephen is G. Stephen. You know, for example, your partner, Stephen, G. Stephen. And I am J. Elizabeth. You know, so it's like we have, when we get a certain point in our life, we say, okay, this. And I think names should be worn sometimes as clothing. You know, it's like, okay, I can do this and I can take that off, et cetera. And it always kind of makes a very interesting idea. So Amy, maybe the named properties of Santa Barbara, maybe the next book, who knows?
Oh, I'm liking your idea. Thank you.
You know, I've wondered about for my paintings, how I should sign them, if I should sign them. I do sign them now as M. Vilken, but if I should have something longer, I'm Michael Gary Vilken. And I was the only Michael Vilken, as far as I know, in the country for many years until the wall fell in Eastern Europe. And now I think if you Google the name, there's six or seven, including, unfortunately, a notorious criminal in San Diego. So I'm glad when people Google my name, mainly I come up as Michael Vilken artist, which is distinguishing.
Well, I think it's interesting. So when Brooks was still around, Amy, I did a lecture, and it was right at the heyday of when the conceptual movement was full bore, and some of the professors at Brooks were saying, please do not sign your work. That's so outre. That's so 70s. That's so, do not sign your work. It's just don't sign your work, you know? And so it's like, we're going to have this career appraiser talk about how signatures are researched. Cause a lot of times, you know, it's a scrawl and, you know, you just bang your head up against the wall. Who signed this painting? And so as I lectured to the Brooks people, please sign your work. I mean, make my life a lot easier. And Michael, in my opinion, you should sign your whole name. Because it makes it a lot. So let's say someone's collecting one of the word paintings in 150 years, and they need to have you researched. It makes it so much easier to have Michael G. Vilken researched than M. Vilken researched, as you know,
right,
from being a former murderer, you see.
Yeah, this was done in prison.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And I thank you very much. It's been so interesting. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
It was a great talk. I just loved it.
We can't wait to have you out.